Okay. What are one of the things that we do during the holiday season? A lot of people, not saying everyone, not even saying most people, but a lot of people do. A little more of than during the rest of the year. How about eating? Eat a little bit more. Well, not saying that there's a connection between this that I'm getting ready to bring up and holiday season, but eating. Eating disorders, I imagine that can be somewhat exacerbated during the holiday season. But had you made a connection between relationship problems and eating disorders? Dr. Judy Scheel broke that down for us a while back. Let's hear that. All right, everyone, welcome back to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr. Thank you so much for your patience as I work to get the technological glitches worked out. And we do have on the line with us our guest, yours and mine, Dr. Judy Scheel. Again, an expert who's been working in the field of eating disorders for more than 20 years, and she has discovered that there is truly a very important component to consider when it comes to helping people with eating disorders, and that is the relationship factor. Dr. Scheel, it is so good to have you with us. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
You know, it is truly my pleasure, and I would love for you, because you can do so much more justice than I can, in sharing with our Speaking With community your profession, you know, your academic training, your academic background, your training background. And after you will have shared that with us, if you would include with us, include with that discussion, how you decided that you would specialize in the area of eating disorders.
Well, I'll start, I guess, from the beginning. My bachelor's degree was in anthropology and foreign language, and I traveled to Mexico. I spent a lot of time in Mexico and in a remote village looking at kind of the cultural component of how people relate and what motivates them. And it felt, even at the bachelor's level, that it wasn't enough to explain human behavior. So I graduated, and then I pursued a master's in clinical social work. My bachelor's is from Purchase College in New York. My master's is from Fordham University in New York. And I got a much more clinical understanding of human behavior, human motivation, the psyche, genetics, biology, in terms of what drives relationships, what drives our thinking, what drives our behavior. From there, that wasn't enough. I went then to NYU for an advanced certification in clinical practice. And I got more theory, more clinical theory, more of the stuff that the old teachings of psychology were based on. So Freud, post-Freud, relational theory, and then moving into kind of the stuff that a lot of practitioners do now, which is also integrated into the treatment of eating disorders, which is cognitive behavioral treatment. So after that, I could have stayed at NYU and pursued my PhD, but instead I had one child at the time, and I was pregnant again, and so I knew I could do my PhD part-time at Yeshiva University. So I went there. It took me 7 years to get my doctorate. And I kind of veered a little bit from the clinical and looked more at values and ethics of the practitioner in terms of what drove them in terms of their practice, how they related to patients, what they valued, how that got conveyed to patients or not. And then worked in organizations and then worked privately, and then went back to NYU Psychoanalytic Institute for a fellowship, was admitted to their psychoanalysis program, and I went for a little bit of time, and I felt that I had done enough training, so I took a departure from there. So that's the long-winded way. that's been my academic training, and then years of my own analysis and treatment, so, which I think, I'll sort of put this in there, that most academic programs do not require clinicians to have been through their own treatment, and I am a very strong proponent of that, because it's my belief that you can only take your patients as far as you've come, and so the more you know about yourself, the better you're able to guide them.
I understand. Well, let me ask you this. I know you mentioned that when you studied the anthropology, actually when you started working in that field, you saw that it really didn't give you the kind of information that you were looking for when it came to relations, helping understand relations. I'm curious, though, whether the anthropology courses, the learning, the experience, had, any relevance to what you later began to discover as you continued your psychology studies and even when you began to practice. Or did it seem like... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Without a doubt, because the relational component is driven from many things, from individuals in the family and their own psychological issues and biological issues and what they then bring to the relationship. And the cultural component, how do people relate within a culture? And, sort of FYI, I have a very small practice in New York that I fly up to once a month. I now live in North Carolina, outside of Boone, and I have a very small practice here in Boone. And ultimately, the human condition is the human condition, and we all sort of boil down to, what drives our own individual love. But I have to tell you, treating patients from a cultural perspective in New York versus the South is obviously very different because you don't have, one, the vernacular. I'm certainly learning to say sir and ma'am a lot more and to kind of curb my New York sensibility. But there's also an element of understanding people within their cultural context. And that can only be done over time, and that's the anthropological component that is inescapable.
Gotcha. That makes sense, too. That definitely makes sense. And so you decided that the psychoanalysis school was not something that you needed to complete. You'd gotten enough of the training that you needed. It was time to practice. And so what various fields do you work on when it comes to the clinical practice, and how did you decide to specialize in eating disorders?
Well, I maintain a general practice and families. I do a lot of family work, which is thrilling because when a family is motivated, it doesn't matter where the problem initiated. It matters that people kind of take responsibility for for what they brought to the situation. Then it works. Everyone sort of bears the burden of the issue, and it's not a blame game. So that's been extraordinary. As far as that is applied to general practice and general psychology and general family practice. The component of about the eating disorders was most people know, although I don't really advertise it because I don't think that it's necessary in you know, treatment setting to talk about one's own history, but the, you know, my own history for one. And two, I was beginning to see more and more eating disorders as I went through various training, various workplaces, worked in an emergency room, worked in an agency, in a hospital. And so there it became more evident. And the incidences of eating disorders have risen dramatically, almost epidemically, and some would say epidemically. And why is that? And that brings us to the discussion of causation, etiology, you know, what drives the clinical bus, you know, for specific patients. And so then we have to kind of pull it back and look at genetics, possibly, although there hasn't been no gene found, and people are hot on the trail to try and discover that. And many of us in the field believe that a specific gene for eating disorders is not likely. But what we are finding is that patients are born, or people are born, with different biological predispositions, and those who may have more of an orientation toward anxiety and or depression may stack the deck more for them to develop an eating disorder later on. But that's not the only component, because lots of people have anxiety and depression and don't develop eating disorders. So what is it that then creates that constellation? And that's where, again, you have to look more within the context of the person's psychological experiences, their internal stuff. That's the stuff that psychoanalysis is made of. You have to look at the family stuff. So how does the family relate to each other? In my book, When Food is Family, I talk a lot about an emotional language that oftentimes families don't have, that emotional language. And so we have feelings, and where do they go if unexpressed? They don't go away. So that's one component to look at in terms of families. Another is, are there issues already existing within the family that perhaps the child who may be more sensitive to develop an eating disorder kind of latches onto and is very troubled by? One kid may get by with, let's say parents are going through a divorce, or let's say one parent has a substance disorder. One child may get by, but the other one kind of latches on, and it becomes very tormenting for them.
Now, let me ask you this, Dr. Shield. We're talking eating disorders. We know that, like you said, we're hearing more and more about that as the years go by. And I can see how anyone interested in helping people working through emotional issues would be thinking, wow, I'm hearing more and more about eating disorders. Maybe this is something that I need to begin to address more in my practice. I can definitely see that. But when we're talking about eating disorders, we're also hearing and reading more and more about so many people around the world, but even particularly in the America, more and more people becoming overweight, more and more people becoming obese, and some of it having to do with eating habits. When we talk about eating disorders, are we necessarily including people who eat to the extent where they become overweight or obese? Or are these two totally different things, eating to the point where people become overweight or obese versus eating disorders?
It's a wonderful question, and it's a complicated answer. Yes, there is a separate diagnostic category for binge eating disorder or eating disorder NOS, not otherwise specified, which includes compulsive eating, graze eating, night eating, that has nothing to do, per se, with the diagnosis of anorexia and or bulimia. There are lots of people who emotionally eat. That does not mean that they have a diagnosable eating disorder. It's done, episodically. Everyone does some things to excess sometimes, many things to excess sometimes. That doesn't diagnose them. There's a component about education and accessibility of food. We live in a culture that food is so available, so it is a very quick fix mentality for many things. And without enough understanding and education about what foods are necessary, we tend to buy into the hype about eating this or eating that, this is going to work to help you lose weight. And the truth is that the diet industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and it is ineffective, and diets don't work. And we've come to know that in the field, that, you can eat change your eating around to restrict or to eat only, you know, specific foods on a diet plan, your body adjusts. It will lose weight. But then when you start to reintroduce normal food again, the metabolism has been messed up. And so weight generally will then come on very quickly. And so that's the causes of the yo-yo dieting. That in and of itself is not a diagnosable eating disorder. That's people falling prey to, I want to lose 10 pounds. They lose 10 pounds, they start to eat, you know, cheese again, and they gain 5 pounds back in a week. So, you know, that's part of what we have to do for our children in terms of helping them understand at home and in school about why healthy eating is important, why, you know, eating breakfast. There's a wonderful study that came out by the AMA, I think in 2012, a major study that showed that people who ate a normal breakfast weighed less than people who did not. And so there it is. So your metabolism is working constantly. It's like a furnace that needs to be fed. And people who ate low fat tended to weigh more than people who ate higher fat.
Interesting.
So, well, yeah, right? So once again, you know, we are tricked to believe, and the diets will work. They'll be a very quick, you know, fix, but they do nothing long-term to keep the person healthy in terms of all their systems, in terms of the development of diabetes down the road and, you know, all things that we see that come as a result of weight. So that's one category, again, non-diagnosable eating disorder. Then there are the people for whom eating is a ritual of emotional soothing. They don't think how they feel. They, you know, they work all day, they come home, and they graze or binge eat all night long. They don't deal with what's going on in their life, as well as what's going on inside of them internally. And again, it is the quickest, as far as substance goes, it's the easiest substance to use. To annihilate pain, to avoid, to distract, and it creates that cycle again of self-worth and self-esteem plummeting because, you know, it reinforces why a person feels bad about themselves and then reinforces the continuing of the eating. That's a diagnosable eating disorder.
And that's where we begin to look at things like anorexia, bulimia, etc.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest, yours and mine, is Dr. Judy Shield. She'll speak with us some more about eating disorders and the family connection as soon as we come back. Stay with us.